Woman wailing for her demon lover. The small quantities of claret that he had allowed himself during the course of the meal seeped warmly through his veins, and soon his own mind began to wander, and provoked by Ridge's question earlier in the meal, he wondered what had lately become of his former... Was friend the word? He seemed more like a succession of extraordinary events than a person. The idea of him actually having friends as such seemed not so much unlikely, more a sort of mismatching of concepts, like the idea of the Suez Crisis popping out for a bun. Svad Chaley, popularly known as Dirk, though again, popular was hardly right, notorious, certainly, sought after, endlessly speculated about, those two were true, but popular... only in the sense that a serious accident on the motorway might be popular. Everyone slows down to have a good look, but no one will get too close to the flames. Infamous was more like it. Svad Chaley, infamously known as Dirk. He was rounder than the average undergraduate and wore more hats. That is to say, there was just the one hat which he habitually wore, but he wore it with a passion that was rare in one so young. The hat was dark red and round, with a very flat brim, and it appeared to move as if balanced on gimbals, which ensured its perfect horizontality at all times, however its owner moved his head. As a hat, it was a remarkable rather than entirely successful piece of personal decoration. It would make an elegant adornment, stylish, shapely, and flattering, if the wearer were a small bedside lamp, but not otherwise. People gravitated around him, drawn in by the stories he denied about himself. But what the source of these stories might be, if not his own denials, was never entirely clear. The tales had to do with the psychic powers that he'd supposedly inherited from his mother's side of the family, who, he claimed, had lived at the smarter end of Transylvania. That is to say, he didn't make any such claim at all, and said it was the most absurd nonsense. He strenuously denied that there were bats of any kind at all in his family, and threatened to sue anybody who put about such malicious fabrications, but he affected, nevertheless, to wear a large and flappy leather coat, and had one of those machines in his room which are supposed to help cure bad backs if you hang upside down from them. He would allow people to discover him hanging from this machine at all kinds of odd hours of the day, and more particularly of the night, expressly so that he could vigorously deny that it had any significance whatsoever. By means of an ingenious series of strategically deployed denials of the most exciting and exotic things, he was able to create the myth that he was a psychic, mystic, telepathic, fey, clairvoyant, psychosassic vampire bat. What did psychosassic mean? It was his own word, and he vigorously denied that it meant anything at all. From this chasm with ceaseless turmoil seething, as if this earth in fast thick pants were breathing, a mighty fountain momently was forced, amid whose swift half-intermitted burst huge fragments vaulted. Dirk had also been perpetually broke. This would change. It was his roommate who started it, a credulous fellow called Mander, who, if the truth were known, had probably been specially selected by Dirk for his credulity. Steve Mander noticed that if ever Dirk went to bed drunk, he would talk in his sleep. Not only that, but the sort of things he would say in his sleep would be things like, "The opening up of trade routes to the mumble mumble burble burble was the turning point for the growth of empire in the snorfootle mumble discuss. Like rebounding hail or chaffy grain beneath the thresher's flail." The first time this happened, Steve Mander sat bolt upright in bed. This was shortly before prelim exams in the second year, and what Dirk had just said, or judiciously mumbled, sounded remarkably like a very likely question in the economic history paper. Mander quietly got up, crossed over to Dirk's bed, and listened very hard, but other than a few completely disconnected mumblings about Schleswig-Holstein and the Franco-Prussian War, the latter being largely directed by Dirk into his pillow, he learnt nothing more. News, however, spread quietly, discreetly, and like wildfire. "And mid these dancing rocks, at once and ever, it flung up momently the sacred river." For the next month, Dirk found himself being constantly wined and dined, in the hope that he would sleep very soundly that night, and dream-speak a few more exam questions. Remarkably, it seemed that the better he was fed, and the finer the vintage of the wine he was given to drink, the less he would tend to sleep facing directly into his pillow. His scheme, therefore, was to exploit his alleged gifts without ever actually claiming to have them. In fact, he would react to stories about his supposed powers with open incredulity, even hostility. "5 miles meandering with a mazy motion, through wood and dale the sacred river ran." then reached the caverns measureless to man, and sank in tumult to a lifeless ocean. And mid this tumult Kubla heard from far ancestral voices prophesying war. Dirk was also, he denied, a clairaudient. He would sometimes hum tunes in his sleep that 2 weeks later would turn out to be a hit for someone. Not too difficult to arrange, really. In fact, he'd always done the bare minimum of research necessary to support these myths. He was lazy, and essentially what he did was allow people's enthusiastic credulity to do the work for him. The laziness was essential. If his supposed feats of the paranormal had been detailed and accurate, then people might have been suspicious and looked for other explanations. On the other hand, the more vague and ambiguous his predictions, the more other people's own wishful thinking would close the credibility gap. Dirk never made much out of it, at least he appeared not to. In fact, the benefit to himself, as a student, of being continually wined and dined at other people's expense was more considerable than anyone would expect unless they sat down and worked out the figures. And of course, he never claimed, in fact he actively denied, that any of it was even remotely true. He was therefore well placed to execute a very nice and tasty little scam come the time of finals. The shadow of the Dome of Pleasure floated midway on the waves. Where was heard the mingled measure from the fountain and the caves, it was a miracle of rare device, a sunny pleasure dome with caves of ice. Good heavens! Reg suddenly seemed to awake with a start from the light doze into which he had gently slipped under the influence of the wine and the reading, and glanced about himself with blank surprise, but nothing had changed. Coleridge's words sang through a warm and contented silence that had settled on the great hall. After another quick frown, Reg settled back into another doze, but this time a slightly more attentive one. A damsel with a dulcimer, in a vision once I saw. It was an Abyssinian maid, and on her dulcimer she played, singing of Mount Aborah. Dirk allowed himself to be persuaded to make, under hypnosis, a firm prediction about what questions would be set for examination that summer. He himself first planted the idea by explaining exactly the sort of thing that he would never, under any circumstances, be prepared to do, though in many ways he would like to, just to have the chance to disprove his alleged and strongly disavowed abilities. And it was on these grounds, carefully prepared, that he eventually agreed, only because it would once and for all scotch the whole silly, immensely, tediously silly business. He would make his predictions by means of automatic writing, under proper supervision, and they would then be sealed in an envelope and deposited at the bank until after the exams. Then they would be opened to see how accurate they had been after the exams. He was, not surprisingly, offered some pretty hefty bribes from a pretty hefty number of people to let them see the predictions he had written down, but he was absolutely shocked by the idea. That, he said, would be dishonest. Could I revive within me her symphony and song, to such a deep delight 'twould win me, that with music loud and long I would build that dome in air, that sunny dome, those caves of ice. Then, a short time later, Dirk allowed himself to be seen around town wearing something of a vexed and solemn expression. At first he waved aside inquirers as to what it was that was bothering him, but eventually he let slip that his mother was going to have to undergo some extremely expensive dental work, which, for reasons that he refused to discuss, would have to be done privately, only there wasn't enough money. From here, the path downward to accepting donations for his mother's supposed medical expenses in return for quick glances at his written exam predictions proved to be sufficiently steep and well-oiled for him to be able to slip down it with a minimum of fuss. Then it further transpired that the only dentist who could perform this mysterious dental operation was an East European surgeon now living in Malibu, and it was in consequence necessary to increase the level of donations rather sharply. He still denied, of course, that his abilities were all that they were cracked up to be. In fact, he denied that they existed at all, and insisted that he would never have embarked on the exercise at all if it wasn't to disprove the whole thing. And also, since other people seemed at their own risk to have a faith in his abilities that he himself did not, he was happy to indulge them to the extent of letting them pay for his sainted mother's operation. He could only emerge well from this situation. Or so he thought. And all who heard should see them there, and all should cry, beware, beware, his flashing eyes, his floating hair. The exam papers Dirk produced under hypnosis by means of automatic writing. He had in fact pieced together simply by doing the same minimum research that any student taking exams would do, studying previous exam papers and seeing what, if any, patterns emerged, and making intelligent guesses about what might come up. He was pretty sure of getting, as anyone would be, a strike rate that was sufficiently high to satisfy the credulous, and sufficiently low for the whole exercise to look perfectly innocent. As indeed it was. What completely blew him out of the water, and caused a furore which ended with him being driven out of Cambridge in the back of a Black Maria, was the fact that all the exam papers he sold turned out to be the same as the papers that were actually set. Exactly, word for word, to the very comma. Wave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honey dew hath fed, and drunk the milk of paradise. And that, apart from a flurry of sensational newspaper reports which exposed him as a fraud, then trumpeted him as the real thing, so that they could have another round of exposing him as a fraud again, and then trumpeting him as the real thing again, until they got bored and found a nice juicy snooker player to harass instead, was that. In the years since then, Richard had run to Dirk from time to time, and had usually been greeted with that kind of guarded half-smile that wants to know if you think it owes you money before it blossoms into one that hopes you will lend it some. Dirk's regular name changes suggested to Richard that he wasn't alone in being treated like this. He felt a tug of sadness that someone who had seemed so shiningly alive within the small confines of a university community should have seemed to fade so much in the light of common day. And he wondered at Reg's asking after him like that, suddenly and out of the blue, in what seemed altogether too airy and casual a manner. He glanced around him again at his lightly snoring neighbour, Reg, at little Sarah, wrapped in silent attention, at the deep hall swathed in darkly glimmering light, at the portraits of old prime ministers and poets hung high in the darkness with just the odd glint of candlelight gleaming off their teeth, at the director of English studies standing reading in his poetry reading voice, at the book of Kubla Khan that the director of English studies held in his hand, and finally, surreptitiously, at his watch. He settled back again. The voice continued, reading the second and altogether stranger part of the poem. Chapter 7. This was the evening of the last day of Gordon Way's life, and he was wondering if the rain would hold off for the weekend. The forecast had said changeable, a misty night tonight followed by bright but chilly days on Friday and Saturday, with maybe a few scattered showers towards the end of Sunday, when everyone would be heading back into town. Everyone, that is, other than Gordon Way. The weather forecast hadn't mentioned that, of course. That wasn't the job of the weather forecast. But then his horoscope had been pretty misleading as well. It had mentioned an unusual amount of planetary activity in his sign, and it urged him to differentiate between what he thought he wanted and what he actually needed, and suggested that he should tackle emotional or work problems with determination and complete honesty, but had inexplicably failed to mention that he would be dead before the day was out. He turned off the motorway near Cambridge and stopped at a small filling station for some petrol, where he sat for a moment, finishing off a call on his car phone. OK, look, I'll call you tomorrow, he said. Or maybe later tonight. Or call me. I should be at the cottage in half an hour. Yes, I know how important the project is to you, all right? I know how important it is, full stop. You want it? I want it. Of course I do. I'm not saying we won't continue to support it. I'm just saying it's expensive and we should look at the whole thing with a determination and complete honesty. Look, why don't you come out to the cottage and we can talk about it? OK, yeah, yes, I know, I understand. Well, think about it, Kate. Talk to you later. Bye. He hung up and continued to sit in his car for a moment. It was a large car. It was a large silver-grey Mercedes, of the sort that they use in advertisements, and not just advertisements for Mercedes. Gordon Way, brother of Susan, employer of Richard Macduff, was a rich man, and the founder and owner of Wayforward Technologies too. Wayforward Technologies itself had, of course, gone bust, for the usual reason, taking his entire first fortune with it. Luckily, he had managed to make another one. The usual reason was that he had been in the business of computer hardware when every 12-year-old in the country had suddenly got bored with boxes that went bing. His second fortune had been made in software instead. As a result of two major pieces of software, one of which was Anthem, the other, more profitable one, had never seen the light of day, Wayforward Technologies 2 was the only British software company that could be mentioned in the same sentence as such major US companies as Microsoft or Lotus. The sentence would probably run along the lines of, Wayforward Technologies 2, unlike such major US companies as Microsoft or Lotus, but it was a start. WayForward was in there, and he owned it. He pushed a tape into the slot on the stereo console. It accepted it with a soft and decorous click, and a moment or two later, Ravel's Bolero floated out of 8 perfectly matched speakers with fine-meshed matte black grills. The stereo was so smooth and spacious you could almost sense the whole ice rink. He tapped his fingers lightly on the padded rim of the steering wheel. He gazed at the dashboard. Tasteful, illuminated figures and tiny, immaculate lights gazed dimly back at him. After a while, he suddenly realized this was a self-service station, and he got out to fill the tank. This took a minute or two. He stood gripping the filler nozzle, stamping his feet in the cold night air, then walked over to the small, grubby kiosk, paid for the petrol, remembered to buy a couple of local maps, and then stood chatting enthusiastically to the cashier for a few minutes about the directions the computer industry was likely to take in the following year, suggesting that parallel processing was going to be the key to really intuitive productivity software, but also strongly doubting whether artificial intelligence research per se, particularly artificial intelligence research based on the Prolog language, was really going to produce any seriously commercial viable products in the foreseeable future, at least as far as the office desktop environment was concerned. A topic that fascinated the cashier, not at all. "The man just liked to talk," he would later tell the police. "Man, I could have walked away to the toilet for 10 minutes and he would have told it all to the till. If I'd been 50 minutes, the till would have walked away too. Yeah, I'm sure that's him," he would add when shown a picture of Gordon Way. "I only wasn't sure at first because in this picture he's got his mouth closed." "And you're absolutely certain you didn't see anything suspicious?" the policeman insisted. "Nothing that struck you as odd in any way at all?" "No, like I said, it was just an ordinary customer on an ordinary night, just like any other night." The policeman stared at him blankly. "Just for the sake of argument," he went on to say, "if I were suddenly to do this..." He made himself go cross-eyed, stuck his tongue out of the corner of his mouth, and danced up and down, twisting his fingers in his ears. "Would anything strike you about that?" "Well, yeah," said the cashier, backing away nervously. "I think you've gone stark raving mad." "Good," said the policeman, putting his notebook away. "It's just that different people sometimes have a different idea of what odd means, you see, sir. If last night was an ordinary night, just like any other night, then I am a pimple on the bottom of the Marquess of Queensbury's aunt. We shall be requiring a statement later, sir. Thank you for your time." That was all yet to come. Tonight, Gordon pushed the maps in his pocket and strolled back towards his car. Standing under the lights in the mist, it had gathered a finely beaded coat of matte moisture on it and looked like, well, it looked like an extremely expensive Mercedes-Benz. Gordon caught himself, just for a millisecond, wishing that he had something like that, but he was now quite adept at fending off that particular line of thought, which only led off in circles and left him feeling depressed and confused. He patted it in a proprietorial manner, then, walking around it, noticed that the boot wasn't closed properly and pushed it shut. It closed with a good, healthy clunk. Well, that made it all worthwhile, didn't it? Good, healthy clunk like that. Old-fashioned values of quality and workmanship. Thought of a dozen things he had to talk to Susan about, and climbed back into the car, pushing the auto-dial code on his phone as soon as the car was prowling back onto the road. "So if you'd like to leave a message, I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Maybe." Beep. "Oh, Susan, hi, it's Gordon," he said, cradling the phone awkwardly on his shoulder. "Just on my way to the cottage. It's a Thursday night, and it's 8:47, a bit misty on the roads. Listen, I have those people from the States coming over this weekend to thrash out the distribution on Anthem version 2, handling the promotion, all that kind of stuff. And look, you know I don't like to ask you this sort of thing, but, you know, I always do anyway, so here it is. I just need to know that Richard is on the case. I mean, really on the case. I can ask him and he says, oh, sure, it's fine. But half the time, shit, that lorry had bright lights. None of these bastard lorry drivers ever dips them properly. It's a wonder I don't end up dead in a ditch. That'd be something, wouldn't it? Leaving your famous last words on somebody's answering machine. There's no reason why these lorries shouldn't have automatic light-activated dipper switches. Look, can you make a note for me to tell Susan, and not you, of course, Secretary Susan at the office, to tell her to send a letter from me to that fellow at the Department of the Environment saying we can provide the technology if he can provide the legislation. It's for the public good, and anyway, he owes me a favour. Plus, what's the good in having a CBE if you can't kick a little ass? You can tell I've been talking to Americans all week. That reminds me, God, I hope I remember to pack the shotguns. What is it with these Americans that they're always so mad to shoot my rabbits? I bought them some maps in the hope that I can persuade them to go on long, healthy walks and take their minds off shooting rabbits. I really feel quite sorry for the creatures. I think I should put up one of the signs on my lawn when the Americans are coming, you know, like they have in Beverly Hills, saying armed response. Make a note to Susan, would you please, to get an armed response sign made up with a sharp spike on the bottom at the right height for rabbits to see. That's Secretary Susan at the office, not you, of course. Now, where was I? Oh, yes, Richard and Anthem too. Susan, that thing has got to be in beta testing in 2 weeks. He tells me it's fine, but every time I see him, he's got a picture of a sofa spinning on his computer screen. He says it's an important concept, but all I see is furniture. People who want their company accounts to sync to them do not want to buy a revolving sofa. Nor do I think he should be turning the erosion patterns of the Himalayas into a flute quintet at this time. And as for what Kate's up to, Susan, well, I can't hide the fact that I get anxious at the salaries and computer time it's eating up. Important long-term research and development it might be, but there's also the possibility, only a possibility I'm saying, but nevertheless a possibility which I think we owe it to ourselves fully to evaluate and explore, which is that it's a lemon. That's odd, there's a noise coming from the boot. I thought I'd just closed it properly. Anyway, the main thing's Richard, and the point is that there's only one person who's really in a position to know if he's getting the important work done, or if he's just dreaming, and that one person is, I'm afraid, Susan. That's you. I mean, of course, not Secretary Susan at the office. So, can you, I don't like to ask you this, I really don't, can you really get on his case? Make him see how important it is. Just make sure he realizes that WayForward Technologies is meant to be an expanding commercial business, not an adventure playground for crunchheads. That's the problem with crunchheads. They have one great idea that actually works, and then they expect you to carry on funding them for years while they sit and calculate the topographies of their navels. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to stop and close that boot properly. It won't be a moment. He put the telephone down on the seat beside him, pulled over onto the grass verge, and got out. As he went to the boot, it opened. A figure rose out of it, shot him through the chest with both barrels of a shotgun, and then went about its business. Gordon Way's astonishment at being suddenly shot dead was nothing to his astonishment at what happened next. Chapter 8. Come in, dear fellow, come in. The door to Reg's set of rooms in college was up a winding set of wooden stairs in the corner of Second Court, and was not well lit. Or rather, it was perfectly well lit when the light was working, but the light was not working, so the door was not well lit, and was furthermore locked. Reg was having difficulty in finding the key from a collection which looked like something that a fit ninja warrior would hurl through the trunk of a tree. Rooms in the older parts of the college have double doors, like airlocks, and like airlocks they are fiddly to open. The outer door is a sturdy slab of grey-painted oak with no features other than a rather narrow slit for letters and a Yale lock, to which suddenly Reg at last found the key. He unlocked it and pulled it open. Behind it lay an ordinary white-panelled door with an ordinary brass doorknob. Come in," repeated Reg, opening this and fumbling for the light switch. For a moment, only the dying embers of a fire in the stone grate threw ghostly red shadows dancing around the room, but then electric light flooded it and extinguished the magic. Reg hesitated on the threshold for a moment, oddly tense, as if wishing to be sure of something before he entered, then bustled in with at least the appearance of cheeriness. It was a large panelled room, which a collection of gently shabby furniture contrived to fill quite comfortably. Against the far wall stood a large and battered old mahogany table with fat, ugly legs, which was laden with books, files, folders, and teetering piles of papers. Standing in its own space on the desk, Richard was amused to note, was actually a battered old abacus. There was a small Regency writing desk standing nearby, which might have been quite valuable if it had not been knocked about so much. Also a couple of elegant Georgian chairs, a portentous Victorian bookcase, and so on. It was, in short, a Don's room. It had a Don's framed maps and prints on the walls, a threadbare and faded Don's carpet on the floor, and it looked as if little had changed in it for decades, which was probably the case because a Don lived in it. Two doors led out from either end of the opposite wall, and Richard knew from previous visits that one led to a study, which looked much like a smaller and more intense version of this room, larger clumps of books, taller piles of paper in more imminent danger of actually falling, furniture which, however old and valuable, was heavily marked with myriad rings of hot tea or coffee cups, on many of which the original cups themselves were probably still standing. The other door led to a small and rather basically equipped kitchen, and a twisty internal staircase, at the top of which lay the professor's bedroom and bathroom. Try and make yourself comfortable on the sofa, invited Reg, fussing around hospitably. I don't know if you'll manage it. It always feels to me as if it's been stuffed with cabbage leaves and cutlery. He peered at Richard seriously. Do you have a good sofa? He inquired. Well, yes, Richard laughed. He was cheered by the silliness of the question. Oh, said Reg solemnly. Well, I wish you'd tell me where you got it. I have endless trouble with them, quite endless. Never found a comfortable one in my life. How do you find yours? He encountered, with a slight air of surprise, a small silver tray he had left out with a decanter of port and three glasses. Well, it's odd you should ask that, said Richard. I've never sat on it. Very wise, insisted Reg earnestly. Very, very wise. He went through a palaver similar to his previous one with his coat and hat. And not that I wouldn't like to, said Richard. It's just that it's stuck halfway up a long flight of stairs which leads up into my flat. As far as I can make it out, the delivery men got it part way up the stairs, got it stuck, turned it around any way they could, couldn't get it any further, and then found, curiously enough, that they couldn't get it back down again. Now that should be impossible. Odd, agreed Reg. I've certainly never come across any irreversible mathematics involving sofas. Could be a new field. Have you spoken to any spatial geometricians? I did better than that, said Richard. I called in a neighbour's kid who used to be able to solve Rubik's Cube in 17 seconds. He sat on a step and stared at it for over an hour before pronouncing it irrevocably stuck. Admittedly, he's a few years older now and has found out about girls, but it's got me puzzled. Carry on talking, my dear fellow, said Reg. I'm most interested. But let me know first if there's anything I can get you. Port, perhaps, or brandy? The port, I think, is the better bet, laid down by the college in 1934. One of the finest vintages, I think you'll find. And on the other hand, I don't actually have any brandy. Or coffee, some more wine, perhaps. There's an excellent Margaux. I've been looking for an excuse to open, though it should, of course, be allowed to stand open for an hour or two, which is not to say that I couldn't. No, he said hurriedly, probably best not to go for the Margaux tonight. Tea is what I'd really like, said Richard, if you have some. Reg raised his eyebrows. Are you sure? I have to drive home. Indeed. Then I shall be a moment or two in the kitchen. Please carry on. I shall still be able to hear you. Continue to tell me of your sofa, and do feel free in the meantime to sit on mine. Has it been stuck there for long? Only about 3 weeks, said Richard, sitting down. I could just saw it up and throw it away, but I can't believe there isn't a logical answer. It's also made me think. It would be really useful to know before you buy a piece of furniture whether it's actually going to fit up the stairs or around the corner. So I've modelled the problem in three dimensions on my computer. So far it just says no way. It says what? Called Reg over the noise of filling the kettle. That it can't be done. I told it to compute the moves necessary to get the sofa out, and it just said there aren't any. I said what? And it said there aren't any. I then asked it, and this is the really mysterious thing, to compute the moves necessary to get the sofa into its present position in the first place. And it said that it couldn't have got there, not without fundamental restructuring of the walls. So either there's something wrong with the fundamental structure of the matter in my walls, or, he added with a sigh, there's something wrong with the programme. Which would you guess? Are you married? Called Reg. What? Oh, I see what you mean, a sofa stuck on the stairs for a month. Well, no, not married as such, but yes, there is a specific girl that I'm not married to. What's she like? What does she do? Well, she's a professional cellist. I have to admit that the sofa has been a bit of a talking point. In fact, she's moved back to her own flat until I get it sorted out. He was suddenly sad, and he stood up and wandered round the room in a desultory sort of way, and ended up in front of the dying fire. He poked at it a little bit, and threw on a couple of extra logs to try and ward off the chill of the room. She's Gordon's sister, in fact, he added at last, but they're very different. I'm not sure she really approves of computers very much, and she doesn't much like his attitude to money. Don't think I entirely blame her, actually, and she doesn't know the half of it. Which is the half she doesn't know? Richard sighed. Well, he said, it's to do with the project which first made the software incarnation of the company profitable. It was called Reason, and in its own way it was sensational. Oh, what was it? Well, it was kind of back-to-front program. It's funny how many of the best ideas are just an old idea back-to-front. You see, there have already been several programs written that help you to arrive at decisions by properly ordering and analysing all the relevant facts, so that they then point naturally towards the right decision. The drawback with these is that the decision which all the properly ordered and analysed facts point to is not necessarily the one you want. Yes, said Reg's voice from the kitchen. Well, Gordon's great insight was to design a programme which allowed you to specify in advance what decision you wished it to reach, and only then to give it all the facts. The programme's task, which it was able to accomplish with consummate ease, was simply to construct a plausible series of logical-sounding steps to connect the premises with the conclusion. And I have to say that it worked brilliantly. Gordon was able to buy himself a Porsche almost immediately, despite being completely broken, a hopeless driver. Even his bank manager was unable to find fault with his reasoning, even when Gordon wrote it off 3 weeks later. Heavens, said Reg, and did the programme sell very well? No, we never sold a single copy. You astonish me. Sounds like a real winner to me. It was, said Richard hesitantly. The entire project was bought up lock, stock and barrel by the Pentagon. The deal put way forward on a very sound financial foundation. Its moral foundation, on the other hand, is not something I would want to trust my weight to. I've recently been analysing a lot of the arguments put forward in favour of the Star Wars project, and if you know what you're looking for, the pattern of the algorithms is very clear. So much so, in fact, that looking at Pentagon policies over the last couple of years, I think I can be fairly sure that the US Navy is using version 2.0 of the program, while the Air Force, for some reason, has only got the beta test version of 1.5. Odd that. Do you have a copy? Said Reg. Certainly not, said Richard. I wouldn't have anything to do with it. Anyway, when the Pentagon bought everything, they bought everything. Every scrap of code, every disk, every notebook. I was glad to see the back of it. If indeed we have, I just busy myself with my own projects. He poked at the fire again and wondered what he was doing here when he had so much work on. Gordon was on at him continually about getting the new super version of Anthem ready for taking advantage of the Macintosh 2, and he was well behind with it. And as for the proposed module for converting incoming Dow Jones stock market information into MIDI data in real time, it only meant that as a joke, but Gordon, of course, had flipped over the idea and insisted on its being implemented. That, too, was meant to be ready, but wasn't. He suddenly knew exactly why it was that he was here. Well, it had been a pleasant evening, even if he couldn't see why Reg had been quite so keen to see him. He picked up a couple of books from the table. The table obviously doubled as a dining table, because although the piles looked as if they had been there for weeks, the absence of dust immediately around them showed that they had been moved recently. Maybe, he thought, the need for amiable chit-chat with somebody different can become as urgent as any other need when you live in a community as enclosed as a Cambridge college was, even nowadays. He was a likeable old fellow, but it was clear from dinner that many of his colleagues found his eccentricities formed a rather rich, sustained diet, particularly when they had so many of their own to contend with. Thought about Susan nagged him, but he was used to that. He flipped through the two books he had picked up. One of them, an elderly one, was an account of the hauntings of Borley Rectory, the most haunted house in England. Its spine was getting raggedy, and the photographic plates were so grey and blurry as to be virtually indistinguishable. A picture he thought must be a very lucky, or faked, shot of a ghostly apparition turned out, when he examined the caption, to be a portrait of the author. The other book was more recent, and by an odd coincidence, was a guide to the Greek islands. He thumbed through it idly, and a piece of paper fell out. "Earl Grey or Lapsang Souchong?" called out Reg. "Or Darjeeling or PG Tips? It's all tea bags anyway, I'm afraid, and none of them very fresh." "Darjeeling will do fine," replied Richard, stooping to pick up the piece of paper. "Milk?" called Reg. "Please. One lump or two? One, please." Richard slipped the paper back into the book, noticing as he did so that it had a hurriedly scribbled note on it. The note said, oddly enough, "Regard this simple silver salt cellar, regard this simple hat." "Sugar?" What? Said Richard, startled. He put the book hurriedly back on the pile. "Just a tiny joke of mine," said Reg cheerily, "to see if people are listening." He emerged beaming from the kitchen, carrying a small tray with two cups on it, which he hurled suddenly to the floor. The tea splashed over the carpet. One of the cups shattered, and the other bounced under the table. Reg leaned against the doorframe, white-faced and staring. A frozen instant of time slid silently by, while Richard was too startled to react. Then he leapt awkwardly forward to help, but the old man was already apologising and offering to make him another cup. Richard helped him to the sofa. "Are you all right?" asked Richard helplessly. Shall I get a doctor?" Reg waved him down. "It's all right," he insisted. I'm perfectly well. I thought I heard, a noise that startled me, but it was nothing. Just overcome with tea fumes, I expect. Let me just catch my breath. I think a little a port will revive me excellently. So sorry, I didn't mean to startle you." He waved in the general direction of the port decanter. Richard hurriedly poured a small glass and gave it to him. What kind of noise?" he asked, wondering what on earth could shock him so much. At that moment came the sound of movement upstairs, and an extraordinary kind of heavy breathing noise. "That," whispered Reg. The glass of port lay shattered at his feet. Upstairs someone seemed to be stamping. "Did you hear it?" "Well, yes." This seemed to relieve the old man. Richard looked nervously up at the ceiling. "Is there someone up there?" he asked, feeling this was a lame question, but one that had to be asked. "No," said Reg in a low voice that shocked Richard with the fear it carried. "No one. No one that should be there." "Then..." Reg was struggling shakily to his feet, but there was suddenly a fierce determination about him. "I must go up there," he said quietly. "I must. Please wait for me here." "Look, what is this?" demanded Richard, standing between Reg and the doorway. "What is it, a burglar? Look, I'll go. I'm sure it's nothing. It's just the wind or something." Richard didn't know why he was saying this. It clearly wasn't the wind, or even anything like the wind, because though the wind might conceivably make heavy breathing noises, it rarely stamped its feet in that way. "No," the old man said, politely but firmly moving him aside. "It is for me to do." Richard followed him helplessly through the door into the small hallway, beyond which lay the tiny kitchen. A dark wooden staircase led up from here. The steps seemed damaged and scuffed. Reg turned on a light. It was a dim one that hung naked at the bottom of the stairwell, and he looked up at it with grim apprehension. "Wait here," he said, and walked up two steps. He then turned and faced Richard with a look of the most profound seriousness on his face. "I am sorry," he said, "that you have become involved in what is... the more difficult side of my life. But you are involved now, regrettable though that may be, and there is something I must ask you. I do not know what awaits me up there, do not know exactly. I do not know if it's something which I have foolishly brought upon myself with my hobbies, or if it is something to which I have fallen an innocent victim. If it is the former, then I have only myself to blame, for I am like a doctor who cannot give up smoking, or perhaps worse still, like an ecologist who cannot give up his car. If the latter, then I hope it may not happen to you. What I must ask you is this. When I come back down these stairs, always supposing, of course, that I do, then if my behaviour strikes you as being in any way odd, if I appear not to be myself, then you must leap on me and wrestle me to the ground. Do you understand? You must prevent me from doing anything I may try to do. But how will I know? Asked an incredulous Richard. Sorry, I don't mean it to sound like that, but I don't know what. You will know, said Reg. Now please wait for me in the main room and close the door. Shaking his head in bewilderment, Richard stepped back and did as he was asked. From inside the large, untidy room, he listened to the sound of the professor's tread mounting the stairs, one at a time. He mounted them with a heavy deliberation, like the ticking of a great slow clock. Richard heard him reach the top landing. There he paused in silence. Seconds went by, 5, maybe 10, maybe 20. Then came again the heavy movement and breath that had first so harrowed the professor. Richard moved quickly to the door, but did not open it. The chill of the room oppressed and disturbed him. He shook his head to try and shake off the feeling, and then held his breath as the footsteps started once again slowly to traverse the 2 yards of landing and to pause there again. After only a few seconds, this time Richard heard the long, slow squeak of a door being opened inch by inch, inch by cautious inch, until it must surely now at last be standing wide agape. Nothing further seemed to happen for a long, long time. Then, at last, the door closed once again, slowly. The footsteps crossed the landing and paused again. Richard backed a few slight steps from the door, staring fixedly at it. Once more the footsteps started to descend the stairs, slowly, deliberately, and quietly, until at last they reached the bottom. Then, after a few seconds more, the door handle began to rotate. The door opened, and Reg walked calmly in. "It's all right. It's just a horse in the bathroom," he said quietly. Richard leapt on him and wrestled him to the ground. "No," gasped Reg. "No, get off me. Let me go. I'm perfectly all right, damn it. It's just a horse, a perfectly ordinary horse." He shook Richard off with no great difficulty, and sat up, puffing and blowing and pushing his hands through his limited hair. Richard stood over him warily, but with great and mounting embarrassment, he edged back and let Reg stand up and sit on a chair. "Just a horse," said Reg, "but thank you for taking me at my word." He brushed himself down. "A horse," repeated Richard. "Ah, yes," said Reg. Richard went out and looked up the stairs, and then came back in. "A horse," he said again. "Yes, it is," said the professor. "Wait," he motioned to Richard, who was about to go out again and investigate. "Let it be. It won't be long." Richard stared in disbelief. "You say there's a horse in your bathroom and all you can do is stand there naming Beatles songs?" The professor looked blankly at him. "Listen," he said, "I'm sorry if I alarmed you earlier. It was just a slight turn. These things happen, my dear fellow. Don't upset yourself about it. Dear me, I've known odder things in my time, many of them far odder. She's only a horse, for heaven's sake. I'll go and let her out later. Please don't concern yourself. Let us revive our spirits with some port." "But how did it get in there?" "Well, the bathroom window's open. I expect you came in through that." Richard looked at him, not for the first and certainly not for the last time, through eyes that were narrowed with suspicion. "You're doing it deliberately, aren't you?" he said. "Doing what, my dear fellow?" "I don't believe there's a horse in your bathroom," said Richard suddenly. "I don't know what is there, I don't know what you're doing, I don't know what any of this evening means, but I don't believe there's a horse in your bathroom." And brushing aside Reg's further protestations, he went up to look. The bathroom was not large. The walls were panelled in old oak linen fold, which, given the age and nature of the building, was quite probably priceless, but otherwise the fittings were stark and institutional. There was old, scuffed, black-and-white checked linoleum on the floor, a small, basic bath, well cleaned, but with very elderly stains and chips in the enamel, and also a small basic basin with a toothbrush and toothpaste in a Duralex beaker standing next to the taps. Screwed into the probably priceless panelling above the basin was a tin, mirror-fronted bathroom cabinet. It looked as if it had been repainted many times, and the mirror was stained round the edges with condensation. The lavatory had an old-fashioned cast-iron chain-pull system. There was an old, cream-painted wooden cupboard standing in the corner, with an old brown bentwood chair next to it, on which lay some neatly folded but threadbare small towels. There was also a large horse in the room, taking up most of it. Richard stared at it, and it stared at Richard in an appraising kind of way. Richard swayed slightly. The horse stood quite still. After a while it looked at the cupboard and said it seemed, if not content, then at least perfectly resigned to being where it was until it was put somewhere else. It also seemed... what was it? It was bathed in the glow of the moonlight that streamed in through the window. The window was open but small, and was, besides, on the second floor, so the notion that the horse had entered by that route was entirely fanciful. There was something odd about the horse, but he couldn't say what. Well, there was one thing that was clearly very odd about it indeed, which is that it was standing in a college bathroom. Maybe that was all. He reached out, rather tentatively, to pat the creature on its neck. It felt normal, firm, glossy, it was in good condition. The effect of the moonlight on its coat was a little mazy, but everything looks a little odd by moonlight. The horse shook its mane a little when he touched it, but didn't seem to mind too much. After the success of patting it, Richard stroked it a few times, and scratched it gently under the jaw. Then he noticed that there was another door into the bathroom, in the far corner. He moved cautiously around the horse and approached the other door. He backed up against it, and pushed it open tentatively. It just opened into the professor's bedroom, a small room cluttered with books and shoes and a small, single bed. This room, too, had another door which opened out onto the landing again. Richard noticed that the floor of the landing was newly scuffed and scratched as the stairs had been, and these marks were consistent with the idea that the horse had somehow been pushed up the stairs. He wouldn't have liked to have had to do it himself, and would have liked to have been the horse having it done to him even less, but it was just about possible. But why? He had one last look at the horse, which had one last look back at him, and then he returned downstairs. "I agree," he said. "You have a horse in your bathroom, and I will, after all, have a little port." He poured some for himself and then some for Reg, who was quietly contemplating the fire, and was in need of a refill. "Just as well I did put out three glasses after all," said Reg chattily. "I wondered why earlier, and now I remember. You asked if you could bring a friend, but appear not to have done so, on account of the sofa, no doubt. Never mind, these things happen. Whoa, not too much, you'll spill it." All horse-related questions left Richard's mind abruptly. "I did?" he said. "Oh yes, I remember now. You rang me back to ask me if it'd be all right, as I recall. I said I would be charmed, and fully intended to be." "I'd saw the thing up if I were you. Don't want to sacrifice your happiness to a sofa. Or maybe she decided that an evening with your old tutor would be blisteringly dull and opted for the more exhilarating course of washing her hair instead. Dear me, I know what I would have done. It's only lack of hair that forces me to pursue such a hectic social round these days." It was Richard's turn to be white-faced and staring. Yes, he had assumed that Susan would not want to come. Yes, he had said to her it would be terribly dull, but she had insisted that she wanted to come because it would be the only way she'd get to see his face for a few minutes, not bathed in the light of a computer screen. So he had agreed and arranged that he would bring her after all. Only he had completely forgotten this. He had not picked her up. He said, "Can I use your phone, please?" Chapter 9. Gordon Way lay on the ground, unclear about what to do. He was dead. There seemed little doubt about that. There was a horrific hole in his chest, but the blood that was gobbing out of it had slowed to a trickle. Otherwise, there was no movement from his chest at all, or indeed from any other part of him. He looked up, and from side to side, and it became clear to him that whatever part of him it was that was moving, it wasn't any part of his body. The mist rolled slowly over him and explained nothing. At a few feet distant from him, his shotgun lay smoking quietly in the grass. He continued to lie there, like someone lying awake at 4 o'clock in the morning, unable to put their mind at rest, but unable to find anything to do with it. He realized that he had just had something of a shock, which might account for his inability to think clearly, but didn't account for his ability actually to think at all. In the great debate that has raged for centuries about what, if anything, happens to you after death, be it heaven, hell, purgatory, or extinction, one thing has never been in doubt: that you would at least know the answer when you were dead. Gordon Way was dead, but he simply hadn't the faintest idea what he was meant to do about it. It wasn't a situation he had encountered before. He sat up. The body that sat up seemed as real to him as the body that still lay slowly cooling on the ground, giving up its blood heat in wraiths of steam that mingled with the mist of the chill night air. Experimenting a bit further, he tried standing up, slowly, wonderingly, and wobblingly. The ground seemed to give him support, it took his weight, but then, of course, he appeared to have no weight that needed to be taken. When he bent to touch the ground, he could feel nothing save a kind of distant, rubbery resistance, like the sensation you get if you try and pick something up when your arm has gone dead. His arm had gone dead, his legs too, and his other arm, and all his torso, and his head. His body was dead. He could not say why his mind was not. He stood in a kind of frozen, sleepless horror, while the mist curled slowly through him. He looked back down at the him, the ghastly, astonished-looking him-thing, lying still and mangled on the ground, and his flesh wanted to creep. Or rather, he wanted flesh that could creep. He wanted flesh, he wanted body. He had none. A sudden cry of horror escaped from his mouth, but was nothing and went nowhere. He shook and felt nothing. Music and a pool of light seeped from his car. He walked towards it. He tried to walk sturdily, but it was a faint and feeble kind of walking, uncertain and, well, insubstantial. The ground felt frail beneath his feet. The door of the car was still open on the driver's side, as he had left it when he had leapt out to deal with the boot lid, thinking he'd only be 2 seconds. That was all of 2 minutes ago now, when he'd been alive. When he'd been a person. When he'd thought he was going to be leaping straight back in and driving off, 2 minutes and a lifetime ago. This was insane, wasn't it? He thought suddenly. He walked around the door and bent down to peer into the external rear-view mirror. He looked exactly like himself, albeit like himself after he'd had a terrible fright, which was to be expected, but that was him, that was normal. This must be something he was imagining. Some horrible kind of a waking dream. He had a sudden thought and tried breathing on the rear-view mirror. Nothing, not a single droplet formed. That would satisfy a doctor, that was what they always did on television. If no mist formed on the mirror, there was no breath. Perhaps, he thought anxiously to himself, perhaps it was something to do with having heated wing mirrors. Didn't this car have heated wing mirrors? Hadn't the salesman gone on and on about heated this, electric that, and servo-assisted the other? Maybe they were digital wing mirrors, that was it, digital, heated, servo-assisted, computer-controlled, breath-resistant wing mirrors. He was, he realised, thinking complete nonsense. He turned slowly and gazed again in apprehension at the body lying on the ground behind him with half its chest blown away. That would certainly satisfy a doctor. The sight would be appalling enough if it was somebody else's body, but his own. He was dead. 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 He tried to make the word toll dramatically in his mind, but it wouldn't. He was not a film soundtrack. He was just dead. Peering at his body in appalled fascination, he gradually became distressed by the expression of asinine stupidity on its face. It was perfectly understandable, of course. It was just such an expression as somebody who was in the middle of being shot with his own shotgun by somebody who had been hiding in the boot of his car might be expected to wear, but he nevertheless disliked the idea that anyone might find him looking like that. He knelt down beside it in the hope of being able to rearrange his features into some semblance of dignity, or at least basic intelligence. It proved to be almost impossibly difficult. He tried to knead the skin, the sickeningly familiar skin, but somehow he couldn't seem to get a proper grip on it, or on anything. It was like trying to model plasticine when your arm has gone to sleep, except that instead of his grip slipping off the model, it would slip through it. In this case, his hand slipped through his face. Nauseated horror and rage swept through him at his sheer bloody blasted impotence, and he was suddenly startled to find himself throttling and shaking his own dead body with a firm and furious grip. He staggered back in amazed shock. All he had managed to do was to add to the inanely stupefied look of the corpse a twisted-up mouth and a squint, and bruises flowering on its neck. He started to sob, and this time sound seemed to come, a strange howling from deep within whatever this thing he had become was. Clutching his hands to his face, he staggered backwards, retreated to his car, and flung himself into the seat. The seat received him in a loose and distant kind of way, like an aunt who disapproves of the last 15 years of your life and will therefore furnish you with a basic sherry but refuses to catch your eye. Could he get himself to a doctor? To avoid facing the absurdity of the idea, he grappled violently with the steering wheel, but his hands slipped through it. He tried to wrestle with the automatic transmission shift and ended up thumping it in rage, but not being able properly to grasp or push it. The stereo was still playing light orchestral music into the telephone, which had been lying on the passenger seat listening patiently all this time. He stared at it and realized with a growing fever of excitement that he was still connected to Susan's telephone answering machine. It was the type that would simply run and run until he hung up. He was still in contact with the world. He tried desperately to pick up the receiver, fumbled, let it slip, and was in the end reduced to bending himself down over its mouthpiece. "Susan!" he cried into it, his voice a hoarse and distant wail on the wind. "Susan! Help me! Help me, for God's sake, Susan! I'm dead! I'm dead! I'm dead, and I don't know what to do!" He broke down again, sobbing in desperation, and tried to cling to the phone like a baby clinging to its blanket for comfort. "Help me, Susan!" he cried again. "Beep," said the phone. He looked down at it again where he was cuddling it. He'd managed to push something after all. He'd managed to push the button which disconnected the call. Feverishly he attempted to grapple the thing again, but it constantly slipped through his fingers and eventually lay immobile on the seat. He could not touch it. He could not push the buttons. In rage, he flung it at the windscreen. It responded to that, all right. It hit the windscreen, careered straight back through him, bounced off the seat, and then lay still on the transmission tunnel, impervious to all his further attempts to touch it. For several minutes still, he sat there, his head nodding slowly, as terror began to recede into blank desolation. A couple of cars passed by, but would have noticed nothing odd. A car stopped by the wayside. Passing swiftly in the night, their headlights would probably not have picked out the body lying in the grass behind the car. They certainly would not have noticed a ghost sitting inside it, crying to himself. He didn't know how long he sat there. He was hardly aware of time passing, only that it didn't seem to pass quickly. There was little external stimulus to mark its passage. He didn't feel cold. In fact, he could almost not remember what cold meant or felt like. He just knew that it was something he would have expected to feel at this moment. Eventually, he stirred from his pathetic huddle. He would have to do something, though he didn't know what. Perhaps he should try and reach his cottage, though he didn't know what he would do when he got there. He just needed something to try for. He needed to make it through the night. Pulling himself together, he slipped out of the car, his foot and knee grazing easily through part of the doorframe. He went to look again at his body, but it wasn't there. As if the night hadn't produced enough shocks already, he started and stared at the damp depression in the grass. His body was not there. Chapter 10. Richard made the hastiest departure that politeness would allow. He said thank you very much, and what a splendid evening it had been, and that any time Reg was coming up to London, he must let him, Richard, know, and was there anything he could do to help about the horse? No? Well, all right then, if you're sure, and thank you again so much. He stood there for a moment or two after the door finally closed, pondering things. He had noticed during a short time that the light from Reg's room flooded out onto the landing of the main staircase that there were no marks on the floorboards there at all. It seemed odd that the horse should only have scuffed the floorboards inside Reg's room. Well, it all seemed very odd, full stop. But here was yet another curious fact to add to the growing pile. This was supposed to have been a relaxing evening away from work. On an impulse, he knocked on the door opposite to Reg's. It took such a long time to be answered that Richard had given up and was turning to go when at last he heard the door creak open. He had a slight shock when he saw that staring sharply up at him like a small and suspicious bird was the Don with the racing yacht keel for a nose. Sorry, said Richard abruptly, but have you seen or heard a horse coming up the staircase tonight? The man stopped his obsessive twitching of his fingers. He cocked his head slightly on one side, and then seemed to need to go on a long journey inside himself to find a voice, which when found turned out to be a thin and soft little one. He said, "That is the first thing anybody has said to me for 17 years, 3 months, and 2 days, 5 hours, 19 minutes, and 20 seconds. I've been counting." He closed the door softly again. Richard virtually ran through second court. When he reached first court, he steadied himself and slowed down to a walking pace. The chill night air was rasping in his lungs, and there was no point in running. He hadn't managed to talk to Susan because Reg's phone wasn't working, and this was another thing that he had been mysteriously coy about. That at least was susceptible of a rational explanation. He probably hadn't paid his phone bill. Richard was about to emerge out onto the street, when instead he decided to pay a quick visit to the porter's lodge, which was tucked away inside the great archway entrance into the college. It was a small hutch-like place filled with keys, messages, and a single electric bar heater. A radio nattered to itself in the background. Excuse me, he said to the large, black-suited man standing behind the counter with his arms folded. Yes, Mr. Macduff, what can I do for you? In his present state of mind, Richard would have been hard-pressed himself to remember his own name and was startled for a moment. However, college porters are legendary for their ability to perform such feats of memory, and for their tendency to show them off at the slightest provocation. Is there, said Richard, a horse anywhere in the college that you know of? You would know if there was a horse in the college, wouldn't you? The porter didn't blink. No, sir, and yes, sir. Anything else I can help you with, Mr. Macduff, sir? No, said Richard, and tapped his fingers a couple of times on the counter. No, thank you. Thank you very much for your help. Nice to see you again, Bob, he hazarded. Good night, then. He left. The porter remained perfectly still, with his arms folded, but shaking his head a very, very little bit. Here's some coffee for you, Bill, said another porter, a short, wiry one, emerging from an inner sanctum with a steaming cup. Getting a bit colder tonight? I think it is, Fred. Thanks, said Bill, taking the cup. He took a sip. You can say what you like about people, they don't get any less peculiar. Fellow in here just now asking if there was a horse in the college. Oh, yes. Fred sipped at his own coffee and let the steam smart his eyes. I had a chap in here earlier, a sort of strange foreign priest. Couldn't understand a word he said at first, but he seemed happy just to stand there by the fire and listen to the news on the radio. Foreigners, eh? In the end, I told him to shoot off, standing in front of my fire like that. Suddenly he says, is that really what he must do? Shoot off? I said in my best Bogart voice, you better believe it, buddy. Really? It sounded more like Jimmy Cagney to me. No, that's my Bogart voice. This is my Jimmy Cagney voice. You better believe it, buddy. Bill frowned at him. Is that your Jimmy Cagney voice? I always thought that was your Kenneth McKellar voice. You don't listen properly, Bill. You haven't got the ear. This is Kenneth McKellar. Oh, you take the high road and I'll take the low road. Oh, I see. I was thinking of the Scottish Kenneth McKellar. So, what did this priest fellow say then, Fred? Oh, he just looked at me straight in the eyes, Bill, and said in this strange sort of, skip the accent, Fred. Just tell me what he said, if it's worth hearing. He just said he did believe me. So, not a very interesting story then, Fred. Well, maybe not. I only mentioned it because he also said that he'd left his horse in a washroom and would I see that it was all right. Chapter 11. Gordon Way drifted miserably along the dark road, or rather tried to drift. He felt that as a ghost, which is what he had to admit to himself he had become, he should be able to drift. He knew little enough about ghosts, but he felt that if you were going to be one, then there ought to be certain compensations for not having a physical body to lug around, and that among them ought to be the ability simply to drift. But no, it seemed he was going to have to walk every step of the way. His aim was to try and make it to his house. He didn't know what he would do when he got there, but even ghosts have to spend the night somewhere, and he felt that being in familiar surroundings might help. Help what? He didn't know. At least the journey gave him an objective, and he would just have to think of another one when he arrived. He trudged despondently from lamppost to lamppost, stopping at each one to look at bits of himself. He was definitely getting a bit wraith-like. At times he would fade almost to nothing, and would seem to be little more than a shadow playing in the mist, a dream of himself that could just evaporate and be gone. At other times he seemed to be almost solid and real again. Once or twice he would try leaning against a lamppost and would fall straight through it if he wasn't careful. At last, and with great reluctance, he actually began to turn his mind to what it was that had happened. Odd, that reluctance. He really didn't want to think about it. Psychologists say that the mind will often try to suppress the memory of traumatic events, and this, he thought, was probably the answer. After all, if having a strange figure jump out of the boot of your own car and shoot you dead didn't count as a traumatic experience, he'd like to know what did. He trudged on wearily. He tried to recall the figure to his mind's eye, but it was like probing a hurting tooth, and he thought of other things. Like, was his will up to date? He couldn't remember and made a mental note to call his lawyer tomorrow, and then made another mental note that he would have to stop making mental notes like that. How would his company survive without him? He didn't like either of the possible answers to that very much. What about his obituary? There was the thought that chilled him to his bones, wherever they'd got to. Would he be able to get hold of a copy? What would it say? They'd better give him a good write-up, the bastards. Look at what he'd done. Single-handedly saved the British software industry. Huge exports, charitable contributions, research scholarships, crossing